Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the 33 Voices Edge Dialogues. With me today to talk about the science of exponentially growing your startup. It's that hyper-growth model that so many people talk about, yet very few people are able to pull off. Is venture capitalist, entrepreneur, and professor of entrepreneurship at Carnegie Mellon, Sean Amoretti. Sean, great to be with you.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
So you invest in entrepreneurs. You teach entrepreneurship. You obviously yourself have been an entrepreneur, having found, you know, started three of your own companies. I'm very curious about the past 5 years in particular, Sean. Tell me what the past 5 years have been like for you.
Yeah, the past 5 years have been amazing. So over the last 5 years, I sold my third startup that I started myself. And at that point had started spending time back at Carnegie Mellon teaching in the entrepreneurship program and really enjoyed that. And so over the last 5 years have really pivoted my time to spending more time doing what I started with, this experience of teaching entrepreneurship at Carnegie Mellon, which is trying to help other people do the same thing that I had done over those dozen years and three startups, which is build companies and really have impact.
How would you say your mindset has changed, if at all, during that period? Because over the last 5 years, the world has seen some remarkable things happen, specifically with the topic that we're going to get into in a minute with this kind of this crazy growth mentality.
Yeah, so I think that it's the mindset has changed in the way that I think people are more interested in being an entrepreneur than ever before. I mean, and yet at the same time, I think some of that interest, they've seen, you know, sitcoms about being an entrepreneur or watched a movie about the experience of being an entrepreneur, and they maybe have even less realistic understanding of what they're signing up for. And so it's interesting, whereas maybe 5 years ago, there would have been a little more evangelism, like, hey, you should consider this career path. Now it's more like, okay, think about what you're really signing up for. Let's see how this maps, and then let's help you really put yourself in the best possible circumstance to be successful. And I think there's a lot of things that have happened to help entrepreneurs learn the right practices, but there's also been a lot of sort of moot Hollywood versions of being an entrepreneur. Yeah. I remember... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, you and I talked about that, and it's so true. I mean, I think this whole concept of entrepreneurship has just been watered down so much. And, you know, one of the things that I'm curious about from your perspective is, what have you learned about the areas in particular that people underestimate about the journey of building something meaningful?
Yeah, so I think that first and foremost, they underappreciate the importance of really the founder's vision aligning with the problem that they're setting out to solve. So, you know, we talk a lot in the book about product market fit and how you know if you're there and that kind of thing so that you can actually get ready to focus on this exponential growth. But even before we get to that, we talk about sort of the founder's vision. How does that line up? Or so you might consider that like the problem founder fit. And I think that's underappreciated. And then just the amount of time that you need to spend and how you need to know if you've actually achieve those milestones to really start focusing on this growth. You know, in the Hollywood version of entrepreneurship, right? You have an idea, click your fingers, and then you got a couple million people, and you're being told that what's cool is a billion people, right? But you know, these overnight success stories are often years of hard work and iterating to get to that point.
Yeah, and very few people ever talk about that. And I think one of the brilliant things that you guys do in the book is, you know, contrasting the companies, you know, the ones who were able to get on that trajectory and the ones who weren't. Was there one major theme maybe that has evolved in your mind of the ones that you research who ultimately failed, may have gotten off to a pretty decent start, but ultimately didn't make it?
Yeah, so I think the failure points, right, we looked at 10 case studies. And as you said, these are people that had about the same product in the market at about the same time. So why did Facebook take off and Friendster didn't? Or why are there tens of thousands of Teslas and now hundreds of thousands of Teslas on back order and Fisker's in bankruptcy? And looked at 10 pairs of these companies. And what we saw was the failure points really broke down into three different categories. There was a group of people who I would say started to think about scaling before they'd satisfied what we call in the book these prerequisites. So I think you can get ahead of yourself and just like you can't do calculus before you do algebra, you can't really focus on scale until you have these prerequisites solved. There's another category of company where I think they missed opportunities to really dramatically accelerate their growth, or what we call these kind of catalysts for growth. And we talk about four broad buckets of those. And then there are a category of them who just, the fundamentals of maintaining that exponential growth rate over time were difficult for them to support in those sort of best practices. There were breakdowns along those.
So in the beginning, you just referenced, I mean, you referenced kind of the three areas that I really want to kind of get into. But one of the first things you talk about is that founder's vision, right? And, and you certainly can't underestimate that.
Yep.
But so during the early days, and you're around these people all the time, what do you see are the founder's most important priorities?
Yeah. So there's a couple things I think that are important about what you just asked. So one thing that's important to say is, just to step back for a minute and say, when we talk about founders or entrepreneurs, right, I'm talking about people who see things that are in the world not the way they should be and create products and services to make the world that way. But if everybody in the world knew that's what the world needed, it'd probably already have been created.
Amen.
And so entrepreneurs sort of have this unique point in time at the early stage of their development where they need to be both contrarian and correct. And so it's important to understand, like, what are you looking at that makes you, what have you observed that the world hasn't that allows you to be contrarian but correct, right? And that's, to me, that's one way you can start to unpack this concept of the founder's vision and how it maps into where you're heading. Once you have that vision, founders need to spend all their time doing two things: making stuff and then making sure the people who want that stuff get it, right? So I often jokingly in MBA classes call it a hacker and a hustler, because it's so contrary to what you would learn in a traditional business school, right? You'll have these, I have great, brilliant students who come to me and they've spent, you know, 5 years at McKinsey and or at a PE firm, and now they're coming back for the MBA. Like, I think I want to be an entrepreneur. It's like, great, what are you going to do? And it's like, well, I'm going to do strategy.
It's like, I spoke to somebody like that the other day.
Yeah, I'm like, strategy. Strategy in a startup is like carrying a bag, going and talking to a customer, yeah, and figuring out what they want, and then coming back to the office and figuring out how through duct tape and paperclip you can deliver that service to them.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And you hear a lot about the first part of the formula that you talked about. Certainly you got to be a contrarian for sure.
Yep.
But the correct piece, you don't hear a lot about that, Sean, because, you know, so many people are trying to embrace this notion of failure and fail fast. And so, and I think sometimes we take that overboard. At some point, you got to get something right.
Correct. That's exactly right. And I think at the end of the day, the way you figure that out is by getting out of your building and talking to your potential customers, right? So, when I spend time with entrepreneurs, they spend a lot of time telling me about all these facts about their business, right? And they'll have filled whiteboards with their team about their vision. But it, even today, even with as much great literature, the stuff that Steve Blank and Eric Ries have advanced over the last 10 years in entrepreneurial education, it is just shocking to me how often they'll talk to, you know, one or two customers, or even more embarrassingly, sometimes no customers, to tell me all these things that they've observed about the market. And it's really, really dangerous. And it dramatically decreases your chances of being exactly that, contrarian but correct. That second part of it, being right, that's informed not just by your IQ, but by the number of customers you've talked to.
Yeah, and I think one of the great encouraging signs to see, I remember 5 years ago when Eric and I were doing an interview precisely right before his book came out, and he thought about doing this conference, hoping to get a small group of people together in a room. And it's right. Just fabulous to see over a four-year period, it's gone from, you know, this tiny group that he envisioned to, I think last year, several thousand people
right.
Getting together. I mean, not only do you see that as a movement, but it's really, it's fascinating to see how everyone gets together, supports one another. And I mean, you know, it's not a matter of drinking the Kool-Aid. It's a matter of doing something that works and following a process that makes sense.
That's right. The transparency in entrepreneurship today is part of what I think has been more valuable to entrepreneurs than they appreciate, right? So, you know, when I was doing my first startup, there were no VCs who blogged about what they expected. There's nothing like AngelList, and there certainly weren't guys like Eric and Steve that were saying, look, here are the best practices. Go apply these to what you're doing to increase the probability of your success, right? And it and I think Eric especially deserves credit for giving vocabulary to some of these things that entrepreneurs have been doing, great entrepreneurs have been doing even before his book came out, but now we had terminology to discuss it, right? So we knew what a minimally viable product is, or what I often call minimally awesome product, or we know what kind of a build, measure, learn cycle is, but now we all have vocabulary. We can talk to each other about that. So I think it's a fantastic, it's been a fantastic run over the last few years from that perspective.
Well, you say in particular that for an idea to be scalable, it has to have projected economies of scale and a large addressable market.
Yeah.
Now, Sean, those seem pretty darn common to me. So why do so many companies, do they just fail and to deliberately ignore these? Is that why, you know, you find the majority of companies still struggling to at least achieve any kind of scale?
Well, so I think as it relates to that point, specifically that prerequisite, a lot of technologists fall in love with what they've created. And the more in love you are with what you've built, the less you want to step back and do that analysis. So to me, that and a lot of the things in the prerequisite are not rocket science. It's not like sizing a market is something that no one has suggested doing before. But I think it's an important question to ask yourself, because to the conversation we were having just a few minutes ago, this is a multi-year commitment you're making. And so far be it from me to tell you how big a market needs to be worth you investing those 2 years of your life. I can tell you how big it needs to be worth me investing my venture dollars into. But for you to decide if this is worth you investing your time into, you ought to at least size up what it ultimately could be around those economies of scale and market size.
Let me ask you about the market size for a second, because that's a little bit tricky, right? There's so many variables that go into that. Do you have a preferred approach for people to measure that?
So what I say is you should go both top down and bottom up in those analysis. And the other thing is, when there's a larger technology trend that's driving a lot of the growth, make sure you're paying attention to not just what that trend drives to, but how that affects your business model. So for example, over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of people who've taken a look at this collaborative consumption trend. Right, and they said, hey, collaborative consumption is going to be this massive part of how we spend money. It's like, great, but as it relates to collaborative consumption for pets, right, nobody may be projecting that, or that might be much more fractional, right? So you have to be careful when you're using those trends. That said, when you can tap into a wave that's much larger than yourself, it can really help you check that prerequisite off solidly.
As an investor now in these early stage companies, how do you know if the entrepreneur that you're investing in or that you're betting on is solving the right problem?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things I can do to try to suss it out, like talk to their customers and talk to them about it and try to understand those underlying first principles. But at the end of the day, it's a risky thing that we do, and ultimately, I'm certainly wrong sometime. The important thing to me is that in situations where I'm right, I want to make sure that that right is very, very meaningful to me and my fund. So I know that a lot of the investments I'm going to make, I'm going to ultimately end up regretting, even though when I make the investment, I'm in love with every investment I make, and I'm sure it's certain to be the next Facebook or Google. But there's a bunch of grenades that go off between that point and ultimately realizing a return. What's important to me is that those ones that are successful, they're not just modestly successful. They're so successful that it changes that entrepreneur's life, and for my investors and the fund, materially impact the returns that our fund is looking for.
Well, part of the contrarian perspective that you share in the book is the whole notion that, hey, first interactions and first impressions still matter, right? Regardless of what you hear, first interactions are really, really critical. What type of an entrepreneur that comes to you and pitches you guys impresses you? When was the last time someone left and you were talking amongst your team or yourself and saying, wow, that's a pretty talented person?
It actually happens pretty regularly. I mean, part of it is partially that I get to know a lot of these guys through my class and my work at Carnegie Mellon, and CMU is just full of people that are really, really impressive. But it happens pretty regularly. I would say the one thing that, as it relates to first interaction around talking to an investor, that's important for entrepreneurs to take into consideration is that rarely do we have, and I would actually probably go so far as to say never, do we have a first meeting and then make an investment. In fact, just as I'm talking this out loud, in my 4+ years investing, I've never had one meeting made an investment.
But do you get a gut feel?
Right. So in terms of that first interaction though, right, the entrepreneurs who come in trying to get me to write a check at the end of the meeting, to me, that's the terrible first interaction. The great first interaction is the entrepreneur who comes in, talks to me about what they're working on, why it's meaningful, the things they're struggling with, and then there's a very logical next meeting coming out of that, right? And it's this sort of, we're early stage investors, so this is not a 6-month process, but it's a multi-week process where you really get to know the entrepreneur, see the problem they're solving. And in some cases, you know, we've said to the entrepreneur, you're too early for us now, but please keep us in mind because, you know, if you prove these out over the next couple of months, we'd love to invest even at a higher price a few months later.
Sean, let me get back to the first interaction piece. Sometimes the notion of MVP is misconstrued. It doesn't mean that you substituted the word awesome in there. Yeah. How do you balance during the early days the importance of design and making a good fit first interaction with the whole concept of get something done fast?
Yeah, so to me, too many entrepreneurs have substituted viable for crappy, mm-hmm. which is why I've substituted it for awesome. My friend Patrick Blaskowitz, who wrote Lean Entrepreneurship, likes to say that's sort of like the difference between a used car sale and a pre-owned car. But to me, like, it's actually deeper than that. What you really are trying to do is the combination of the word minimal and awesome, right? So Eric's definition of MVP is the minimum amount of functionality that you can deliver to a customer to learn as much about that customer as possible with the least amount of work. And the problem that a lot of entrepreneurs overlook is when they deliver a really crappy interface to somebody, they actually don't learn that much about the customer because the customer is reacting to the interface, not the product. And so to me, great, minimally awesome products are those products where they only have a little bit of functionality. Right? Maybe it's a landing page, maybe it's a Wizard of Oz experience, maybe it's a video, but that minimum amount of functionality is done with excellence so that you can learn as much as possible from the interactions that your customers have with that product. The other thing I love about MAP versus MVP is it's exactly what these things are. They're a map for the future, right? MVP is a sports term and it's a fine one, but it's not actually relevant to what you're trying to do. What you're trying to do with a minimally awesome product or a minimally viable for that matter is map out your future, right? You have a bunch of unvalidated hypotheses about your business and you're trying to learn as much of them as you can as quickly as possible to map out the trajectory your business is on.
And that shifts completely your mindset. If you're an entrepreneur or builder approaching things from that perspective, it totally shifts your mindset. It's not about how quickly can I get something out there. It's literally how do I synthesize all these amazing features and come up with the one best thing that's going to make the best impression on people. It's a whole different game.
That's been my experience.
Let's talk about the four growth catalysts that you mentioned earlier and that you discuss in the book. You start with what you call double trigger events. You're the first one that I've really seen dig as deep into this topic, which is essentially kind of that launch phase as you have. Tell me what the best outcome is here and what can we learn from the companies you've studied?
Yeah, so when I first started talking about these, I actually used that term launch, that these were the company's launch, because often the things that we're talking about here later are called their launch. But going back to the prerequisites, right, I want you to be showing the product to people long before you ever have this launch experience. And so I realized it's almost like a second launch, right? It's like Twitter didn't launch at South by Southwest in the sense that it wasn't unveiled for the first time at South by Southwest. It actually launched a year earlier, but it had this catalytic moment where user growth took off and really never looked back at South by Southwest. Airbnb had the same experience with the DNC convention in Denver, Colorado, when Obama was nominated for the Democrats. Right, they moved that event from inside an arena to an outdoor stadium, and now 50,000 more people can come. Mm-hmm. Except for there's not a hotel room from Colorado Springs to Boulder available. And so what do people do? They start listing their homes And what do you know? There's this platform, Airbnb, that allows people to do that. And so I think the idea here is, how do you think about events that are going on where your product can be part of what's going on there, part of a bigger event than yourself, to really create this momentum? I think launch is a bit of a loaded word in entrepreneurship today, because we both hear great quotes from guys like Reid Hoffman: launch early enough to be embarrassed by your first product. And yet, they get other advice, like make sure that first experience is minimally awesome, right? And so launch is just a word that I think there's enough cognitive load around it that it's worth sort of using other terms to talk about. What are you doing? So are you trying to put this into people's hands to learn information about them? Or are you trying to really, you satisfied those things and now you're trying to help the world catch up with your vision, right? Help the world catch up with the contrarian things that you've realized and others haven't. And sometimes there still are actual events, or what I would call double trigger events, for you to plug into to really accelerate that growth.
Yeah, which makes so much sense, man. You know, if you just have heard the last 3 minutes of your dialogue around this issue, they just make so much sense. You know, we've had some very intriguing conversations over the past few months about the power of platforms. It happens to be another catalyst for you. And there are some convincing examples of some companies who've really established themselves as part of platforms or off other platforms. But are platforms applicable for most companies, Sean?
Well, so I think this is an important point about all four catalysts, right? I am not saying every company needs to do all four of these. So whereas all four prerequisites, what we talked about earlier, to me, you need to satisfy before you move on to the next one. Think of these more like a grab bag that you can think about to help the world catch up with your vision, right? And so sometimes that's an in-person event. Sometimes that's a platform, right? Sometimes that's viral growth. Any of these are things you can think of. Sometimes it's optimizing around a set of algorithms. But as it relates to platforms, what I think is really important here is that for certain, there are platforms out there where people have the problem that a given entrepreneur's solution solves, and they're searching for that problem. And if you can make it really efficient to solve that problem within the platform, that can dramatically accelerate your growth, right? So what eBay did for PayPal, or what MySpace did for YouTube, those were amazing catalysts to drive their growth. When you end up in that situation, you do need to actually spend time also thinking about how you fit into that platform for the long term, right? Because both YouTube and Rever plugged into MySpace for a while. But I would argue that how YouTube navigated interacting with that platform versus Rever was a significant impact on why one ultimately sold to Google for over $1 billion and why one sold for less than $5 million.
So certainly the platform makes sense, but it also ties into your next one. You know, they understand the data. They understand, you call it optimizing algorithms.
Yeah.
And I don't want to skip that one, but I want to go to the next one, which is about this whole notion of viral. Again, that's one of the topics that I don't need to tell you. Far too many people talk about, far too many people think they've got figured out. Do you see that as a strategic approach to growth?
I do. So, I think as it relates to the people talking about it, one thing I think that's important to say is that viral growth is not new. Viral growth has been a lot. People telling people about products happened long before Mark Zuckerberg was born, right? But, I mean, so that's not a new phenomenon.
It's a fact, you're right.
What is new is that we can measure it, right? And that we can optimize it. Those two things were much harder to do when it was your or my grandfather sitting on a porch stoop talking to his buddy across the street, right? There's nobody Colgate wasn't able to measure that viral referral and then optimize that loop, right? So it's not new that people refer products or services, but it is great that you can actually measure how that works and then optimize the flow of that. And as it relates to this concept of really catalyzing growth, what I think is interesting is over the last few years, people have gotten really good at doing that math and figuring out how to optimize those feedback loops to really, again, come back to this hired a bit that you're trying to solve with the catalyzing events, which is how do you dramatically accelerate the awareness about your product or service?
How do you begin to think about viral as a strategy?
So I think the first question to ask yourself is not the math question, although I think the math question is what ultimately sure. gets powerful. The first question to ask yourself is, how are your customers naturally talking to other prospects about your product or service, right? This concept that this is not a new thing. And so I think it's really important to understand what parts of interacting with your product, what parts of your customer's average life are places where they could do this viral interaction in a natural, organic way. Once you understand that, then you can quickly establish a baseline for the math behind it, and then start to run experiments to understand how you can optimize both the number of referrals that they send out, and then also how quickly you can get them to that experience where they've been organically doing it, but can you pull that forward so that maybe they're sending those referrals out in 2 days instead of 2 weeks, which when you iterate through multiple cycles there, that can have a meaningfully or dramatically different impact on the number of customers that you're looking at a given point in time.
But it's strategic, and you have to look
strategic.
At it like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's coming back to what founders do. It's half of what you're doing in the business, right? It's all about getting customers, which is half of the entrepreneurial game.
Yeah, it's not about the cat videos. All right, let's shift gears for a moment for our remaining time and talk about building an enduring business. Again, very few people get into the particulars of that. We talk about it, we're building this business for 100 years, but they don't get into the specifics of kind of that built to last variety as you have. You deconstructed it by first saying that it starts with being data informed. Not data driven, data informed. We hear a lot about being data driven. How does a company like Facebook, of which you profile, or even WordPress, how do they become data informed, and what can we learn from them?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So I think I mentioned we did these 10 pairs of companies. We also took 5 companies that we sort of used as sanity checks for what we found, where there wasn't an obvious contrasting company, but we felt like they were such a great example of hypergrowth that we had to include them in the case study. So PayPal, that I've already mentioned, was part of that. Google was another company in that sort of reference category. And I kept pushing back as the grad students that I was working with on this research kept coming back on this. Well, they use data in this interesting way and saying, like, look, everybody knows Google is a completely data-driven company. And as we were probably 2/3 through formulating the model, I went and read Eric Schmidt's book, and he talks about the kind of worker he's looking for, and he mm-hmm. basically lays out this exact same concept that the knowledge worker he's looking for is one who uses data but adds expertise together to make these informed decisions. And at that moment, I sort of relented and reverted back to this phrase that we'd actually stolen from we didn't steal, but we borrowed with attribution from a Facebook product manager who gave a talk where he talked about Facebook. We like to be data informed, but not data driven. And to me, that's the magic there. The magic is where you add human expertise for the things and strategic expertise for the things that you can't quantify, and then you optimize those things using quantitative data. Because if all of your decisions are driven by data, you'll end up often optimizing to local maximas. And to make those step function improvements, right, you often need to add, or I would argue you almost always need to add that business expertise, that bit human intuition to help you see those new hills that you can climb.
How does a company like Automattic, it seems like they're almost built that way. The parent company of WordPress, it seems like from the ground up, that's how they were built.
Yeah, so I think Automattic is a really, really interesting company. As we think about the future of work, it's a company I would encourage all of your listeners to spend time looking at along all of these dimensions, right? They do a really, really good job recruiting people. I mean, all the things that are highlighted in these 5 best practices, they do a great job. And for more of a biographical look at Automattic, I would encourage your readers to look at a book by Scott called A Year Without Pants. It's an amazing awesome profile of his year as a product manager there. But as it relates to this concept of data, right, one of the things that they do an amazing job with is that they have so much data flowing through their system all the time that they're able to run these sort of micro experiments all the time to sort of see what the optimizations are. Yet at the same time, they have the ability for anybody to propose these hypotheses, bring these hypotheses to bear, and actually run experiments to kind of see where there might be these step function changes as well.
And if anybody's ever used WordPress, you've seen it. When do you know you're around a high-performing team?
So the high-performing team thing was tension for a different reason, right? So, and I say this in the book as well. It's not that there weren't high performers in both of the companies that took off and the companies that didn't. I mean, I have plenty of friends. Hopefully, they'll still be friends after the book comes out, who worked at the places that didn't scale, and they are very smart. But what I came to appreciate was, as it relates to HR and talent and recruiting, these scaling companies built absolute machinery to repeat that process over and over again. Because one of the things that's interesting about recruiting talent is it's like a lot of other things where investing is another example of this, sports is another example of this, where it's really hard to delineate between skill and luck mm-hmm. on small sample size. And so hiring three really smart people is how to know if you were lucky or really good at hiring. But having a replicable process where you're repeatedly hiring really great people, to me that moves into skill. And so there were a number of things that we saw around their HR processes, which we talk about, that really allowed them to build out these high-performing teams as they scaled up.
Not too dissimilar than a team like in your backyard, the Pittsburgh Steelers. Right,
yes.
Seriously, or the Patriots. I mean, when you really think about what you profile, those are the first two that came to mind.
It's absolutely true. So I grew up in Cleveland, and
that's not like it's not like that
it's
over
not
there.
Not like that in Cleveland. And actually, that was one of the. It was a snowy November, and one of my researchers who was working with me on these case studies and I were debating about this high performing team, and he's like, "Are you going to actually tell me that the difference between the Browns and the Steelers is luck?" And it's like, well, man, the last 20 years would certainly tell you it's something more than that they got lucky 20 years in a row. I think there are interesting analogs to sports there for sure.
Yeah, well, they just hired the Moneyball guy in Cleveland, right?
So I'm well aware.
It'd be fascinating to see what happens. All right, two more quick things for you, Sean. Perhaps the biggest catalyst to any of this long-term success is a powerful network. All right. How do you maximize it without abusing it? Because it's a fine line.
It is. So it's interesting because I think network effects, it's important to break these into two categories, right? There are network effects where the business is a network, LinkedIn, Facebook, right? And in those cases, there's interesting things you can do to strengthen and amplify those networks. Some of this gets back to being data informed, that data driven, things like that. But even more interesting to me, as I think about entrepreneurship at large, is businesses that don't have network effects built into their product, but come up with these, for lack of a better term, secondary network effects
sure.
that surround their product.
Yeah.
So the most interesting example that's especially timely right now with the Model 3 coming out is the Tesla Supercharger network, right? Teslas in and of themselves, there is no network effect in having a Tesla, but it turns out building out this secondary product of Supercharger networks creates a network effect not just for the existing customers, but it's truly now a network effect for every person who's pre-ordering one of those Model 3s.
Which is, it's a brilliant, I mean, that's a whole case study in and of itself and how they, you know, he's following a very similar model to PayPal. I mean, the way that the referral network's working, I mean, they've done an amazing job. But if that continues to work that way, Sean, that probably could go down in history as one of the most fascinating start-to-finish companies that maybe we've ever witnessed.
I think Tesla's an amazing story, right? I mean, you know, Elon is an amazing entrepreneur. The founder's vision of being contrarian and right, it'd be hard to be more contrarian and more right than he's been. Things like, after he sells PayPal to eBay and has all of this wealth, he literally goes to the point of bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. Writing a $3 million check to keep the lights on at Tesla to keep things going, right? So amazing entrepreneur, an amazing ride. But as it relates specifically to this point of network effects, I actually think the supercharger network is a completely underappreciated tactic still today. I mean, people talk about it in terms of the benefits, like, oh, you can drive from here to there. But what he's really doing, right, is he's saying, not only electric vehicle is going to be powerful, but here's a way to catalyze the value of every electric vehicle that I sell. My intuition is, if you fast forward 4 years, in the same way that viral growth has gone from something that startups in Silicon Valley are aware of, to this concept of network effects, even when your business doesn't have a network built into it, I think that will be a similar topic in the business lexicon in a few years, as people see these businesses like Tesla, as an example, create these network effects, even when their business is not a network product by definition.
I would definitely not bet against them. So lastly, you're a venture capitalist. As an investment partner, if you had to design a learning curriculum for your early stage portfolio companies, what would it look like?
Yeah, so I mean, it would look probably not surprisingly a lot like what we do at Carnegie Mellon, because I have a lot of influence over that. Obviously, one of my mentors, Dave Mawinney, has even more. But to me, it's, you can teach best practices, and then you need to have the entrepreneur go out and experience what they're learning there. So I think that's part of it. And I think we do a really good job having entrepreneurs have this blended, learn a best practice, apply that best practice. Because I don't think you can get entrepreneur curriculum just from sitting in a classroom and, sure, and reading, right? Even in the book, I try to, at the end of each chapter, give you things that you can do to put the best practices we're talking about into place. So that would be part of it. The other thing I think that I would really and have tried to do at Carnegie Mellon is to help entrepreneurs aim big. So Eric Schmidt in the book that I talked about has a preface by Larry Page, and he says in the book, like, people underappreciate moonshots because they're just not trained to do it. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think part of what you can do in early stage entrepreneurs is help those entrepreneurs dream big. So going back to this idea of, you asked me about my investment portfolio earlier and like, how do I know they're going to be successful? I don't, but I want to make sure when entrepreneurs embark on these things, they're aiming for things that, if successful, they're meaningful enough to them and meaningful enough to me as an early stage investor to make it worth all the risk involved in it.
That's a whole mindset. I mean, and you certainly can build a curriculum around that. And very quickly, as the companies mature, Sean, as the companies kind of get out of that early stage, how does that learning shift? What do you want them to know then, especially the founding team?
Yeah, so I think for the founding team and for everybody involved at the early days, right, when you start to scale up, it does become a team game, right? So, as much as it's fun to make fun of the McKinsey guy who wants to do strategy in the four-person founding team, you know, at a certain point along a company's development, somebody needs to be thinking about product roadmaps more than 2 months out into the future. And that is a different mindset often than the, can I keep the lights on and can I figure out how to satisfy this quarter's quota? And so that does often require you to hire other people and get them involved. I'm not a big proponent of this, you have to replace the founder or you can't replace the founder. Like, I think that's a much more situational thing than people think about. But I think it's important for, no matter how you staff up this group, that you add people to the team that ultimately allow you to complement the weaknesses of whatever the founders may or may not have built into their background and philosophies.
Well, I want to commend you for the work that you're doing and sharing the, you don't have to do that, but the depth that you go into in this book and just the information that you share. I mentioned to somebody earlier today, you combine that with Eric's book or any other true book about how do I get something started. I think you have a really good package if you want to self-taught, teach yourself how to get something off the ground. So hopefully we can build on this. Thanks for your time.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.